and you all had filed a response, and Commonwealth has filed a reply. Anything you all wish to say on that matter other than what you all have filed?
I'd actually like a little bit more time with this, frankly. In the Commonwealth's first motion, the Commonwealth didn't cite any sources besides 901, and then yesterday when the new filing came through, there were two
cases. Right.
And the Commonwealth has accused us, frankly, of misunderstanding the basis for the original ruling, which gives us pause and makes us want to go back through and make sure we firmly understand the Commonwealth's position. My understanding is now, just to clarify, I don't want to put words in the Commonwealth's mouth, but just to make sure I understand their position, my belief is that their argument is that Detective Hill should be able to authenticate for 901 purposes surveillance videos if he went in person, watched the videos on the system that was provided, and then got a copy from an employee of that record that he just witnessed. And if that's their position, then I want to respond to that. If that's not, then I want to know what it is.
Yes, that is my position, and I think the reply is clear on that. I have attached cases that support that position. I'm asking the court just to issue an order on that narrow issue. I'm not asking the court issue an order giving us specifics on how we need to authenticate the videos. I just want the court to rule on my motion on that specific issue. There are different ways that videos can be authenticated. I felt like, as I said in my reply, I needed to go ahead and file that just to make sure that we didn't have any issues come trial time. So I'm just asking for the court to issue an order on that very narrow issue that has been laid out.
Mr. Lonozak, I will give you time to quickly make a, if you'd like to make a sir reply to the reply. Let me give you 2 weeks to do that.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. 2 weeks with the holidays is a little more confusing, frankly, than it would be otherwise. What is
right.
That?
Well, how about we'll let you file it by January 6th? Is that okay?
That's okay. One point of issue, too, that I wanted to clear up is there was a reference to a prior ruling by the court, but again, like I said, there wasn't a lot of authority in the initial filings, so I didn't know if the Commonwealth or the court were aware of additional authority that went into the court's prior ruling. Obviously, we're at a disadvantage not knowing what this is about.
My understanding is that prior ruling was from an unrelated trial that we had in Caldwell County where I ruled a surveillance tape would not be admissible at the trial in a similar way. I think that's why Commonwealth has filed its motion.
Yes, that Mr. Nelson tried that case. The court issued a ruling and didn't allow him to play or introduce some surveillance footage. I just to be candid, I didn't agree with that ruling, and that's why I have put it in a motion before the court. I didn't want that to happen in this trial, so I wanted to hash it out pre-trial.
And there was it wasn't purely identical because in that case, the video was turned over by the Commonwealth, I think, the Friday before the Monday trial. Is that about right? Is that right? More or less?
More or less.
Okay, and obviously, the defense had not had time to really review it, and so I kind of felt like there was a discovery fairness side to that as well, which was part of my calculus, which is different than this case.
Certainly, Your Honor. The concern we have, and again, because I'm sort of punching in the dark, so to speak, because I wasn't privy to any of the info in that case, is if there's authority that the defense in that case relied on to support their position. Oh, that's what I mean.
There wasn't any authority. It was not that I don't think there was any authority.
It was a
heated trial. No briefs or any. It was just an objection and a ruling at bench. So
Ms. Rohrer was the attorney on that case, though. If you want to talk to her, she may have had some time to think about it.
Ms. Rohrer always has good authority on the tip of her tongue. Mr. Lonozak should be good help for you, I'm sure.
Thank you.
So we'll let you make a sir reply on January 6th, and we will take it, and I will rule very quickly after that so you all can prepare. However, I do caution Commonwealth to be prepared in case I rule as defense is arguing. All right. So the motion for reciprocal discovery that Commonwealth had filed earlier, I noted that when we were last here, you had indicated you were satisfied that.
Judge, of course, I don't know what all they have to provide. They had indicated that they had provided everything that they needed to. One of the issues is I haven't received anything from any experts other than Ms. Markopoulos. I hope I'm saying that correctly. And that really doesn't go toward the merits part of the trial. So I would ask for a deadline in the very near future if they are going to call any witnesses. I would ask that they comply with the rule and give me notice, summary of what they're going to testify to if they don't have a report.
Do you all plan on having any other experts other than Dr. Markopoulos?
Yeah, go ahead. Okay. Yeah, Judge, we have our DNA expert and our cell phone expert. They're going off of discovery materials, so it's not like they're generating new information, but we need to provide notice of those two specifically, because there was a period of time where we were trying to figure out if we were just going to continue using them as consulting witnesses or whether they would actually testify. And I think we'll just go ahead and disclose all that in the event that they do testify. We're still kind of on the fence when it comes to that issue.
And you say there's a DNA expert and a cell phone expert?
Yes, Judge.
Okay. Ms. Ovi Wiggins, and I'll have you tender me an order that provides me granting your motion for reciprocal discovery and placing language in there for defense to tender any expert disclosure.
And just so the Commonwealth is also aware, so Dr. Markopoulos, we anticipate testifying during the penalty phase, and then we have a childhood trauma expert, Dr. Garbarino, who's essentially going to be somewhat of a teaching expert who will also be testifying during the penalty phase, so we'll include that as well. And that should cover all of the experts.
Would you all be able to make this filing by January 6th? Because they are getting close to trial, and we need to.
Judge, could we have until the 10th just to make sure that.
All right, come on.
10th? That's acceptable. Okay. Thank you.
All right, and we'll let Ms. Sylvie Wiggins tender that order. Okay, Commonwealth to tender order on that.
And then there are some other things that we'll also, just to also give the Commonwealth a heads up. I mean, when it comes to some of the penalty phase, reciprocal discovery, I mean, photos. The records that were received via court order in terms of DCBS, like all that kind of stuff, we'll try to turn that over as well as soon as we can.
All right. Okay. All right. Let's talk about the Bill of Particulars. Mr. Lonizak, you had filed a motion for Bill of Particulars.
Yes, Your Honor. We filed a motion for a bill of particulars, and we believe a bill of particulars is necessary in the case. I've seen and had an opportunity to review their response, which effectively, my understanding is, says this is all information in the discovery, and we respectfully disagree with that position. We asked for the specific acts and accompanying mental states, the accompanying the charges and the indictments. We also have very specific questions as they relate to these things that we think we're entitled to, frankly, because they do cast doubt on what the Commonwealth's position is and how they intend to pursue these charges. One issue is we asked specifically for information related to how Jonathan McCoy is purported to have committed murder. In the discovery, we have information from the medical examiner who lists two separate causes of death. That on its face is a reason for us to ask, what's your theory of how this murder was committed? In the kidnapping charge, I cited to the statute KRS 509-050, which specifically says kidnapping, you can't be convicted of kidnapping if it occurs during the course of the commission of another felony and doesn't exceed the scope of that felony. the idea being very simply that if somebody could avoid being robbed or burgled or assaulted by leaving, they would, and sort of being forced to be the victim of crime is part of those crimes and not its own independent charge just because it might tangentially involve the restriction of liberty. And so I asked, in what way did this exceed the scope of, because those are necessary elements of the offense, in what way did this exceed the scope of these other felonies? And in fact, in their response, or not in their response, but in a collateral document that they filed yesterday, the motion, or the notice of additional grounds or aggravating circumstances, they seem to admit that this was in the course of the burglary, part of and parcel of the burglary. So I don't think that it's in the discovery in what way this kidnapping is supposed to have occurred separate and remote from these two, or excessive to these other charges. When it comes to conduct that's supposed to offend the sensibilities as it relates to tampering with the corpse, we asked specifically what acts Mr. McCoy committed and what evidence there is to support that. What offends the sensibilities of a reasonable juror is fairly subjective, and so is it the argument put forth by the prosecution that he abandoned the body in a particular way? Is it the fire itself? Is there some other aspect to this, some argument that he tampered with the body after the fact that they're saying makes up the basis for this? There are lots of information here, Your Honor, about how these charges, how these elements are supposed to be met that we shouldn't have to guess at, that we shouldn't have to put these in and say, well, I think they're aiming at this, let's give it a shot. So we're just asking for just a short, plain statement of how they intend to prove these things.
Sophie Wiggin.
Your Honor, my response is what it is. I think all of this is in the discovery. I think it's all laid out pretty clearly in the discovery. I mean, if the court is going to make me respond to this bill of particulars, I'm just going to read through the file and write what's in the discovery. And that's just not necessary. I mean, what are the specific acts or conduct taken by Jonathan McCoy that the Commonwealth believes support the charge of murder? She was strangled. I mean, I don't know how much clearer it can be. It's in the discovery. They have the reports. You know, I don't know what else to say about it. You know, what evidence supports kidnapping? Her hands are bound behind her back with a cord. I mean, this is all information that they've had from day one when we provided discovery.
All right. In the event I would grant their request, how long would Commonwealth need? I'm not sure I'm going to rule on this.
Till the 10th.
I'll take that under advisement. Mr. Lonizak, you'd also filed a motion to exclude surveillance videos, and Ms. Sophie Wiggins has responded. Would you like to be heard on that?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it was Mr. Nelson who filed the response.
I'm sorry. Mr. Nelson had.
And just to be specific, we're specifically looking to exclude any evidence of the purchase of the gas can and gas from Jonathan McCoy. So the receipt found at Walmart and the surveillance video. And our argument is fairly straightforward. They did an arson investigation. The arson investigation found no evidence of an accelerant. If you wanted to, and so the gas is therefore irrelevant. It doesn't make any fact of the case more or less likely. They don't know that it's connected in any way. There's kind of this reverse corpus delicti issue. And there's cases directly on point that say, effectively, if you don't know what, it relates to the issue of a murder weapon, which I think is frankly an apples to apples comparison with the way that this case is being conducted, that says that you have to sort of almost pass a 901 authentication boundary to introduce real evidence, sort of couched in this relevance argument, right? So you have to show that there's some connection between this object you're introducing and the scene and the crime and the manner that was carried out. That evidence just doesn't exist here in the arson. And in the response, which frankly I find a little frustrating because it states that I effectively made my filing in bad faith and intentionally misled the court, the Commonwealth seems to ignore those points and says instead we have other evidence that an arson was committed, which is great, you know, it's in dispute. I do think they misstate and over-exaggerate that evidence, not least of which, especially, their statement that evidence is going to show Jonathan McCoy committed the other crimes and offense. Frankly, I think that's a mis... Well, I mean, between the DNA evidence and between other things, I think that that kind of misstates the facts and presumes that they're going to win the trial. I can appreciate that that's the point of view. I think, in hindsight, that's going to look a little misleading as it was applied to this motion. And I can go through more of these, Your Honor. They talk about, they state that Mr. McCoy's phone was powered off for approximately, or that Mr. McCoy powered off his phone for approximately 1 hour. The digital forensics information is going to show that while the phone was off, there's no evidence that he turned it off manually. That's an overstatement in order to bolster their argument. But frankly, none of that's relevant because we're not filing a motion to say, let's dismiss the arson charge for lack of probable cause or for misleading the grand jury or whatever else, whatever mechanical grounds we have. We're saying you have an arson where there's no proof that an accelerant was used. You can't use his innocuous task of buying a gas can and filling it with gas as evidence because it doesn't make any effect in the case more or less likely. And just to expand on that, too, in giving them the benefit of the doubt, they've made arguments and they put forth a 404B argument that they can talk about these two other cases, or these two other fires that occurred in Mr. McCoy's past, one with a truck and one with his trailer. Neither of those involved gasoline. So any way you cut it, he wouldn't have needed gasoline to start an arson, or to start a fire to commit an arson. He certainly wouldn't have needed gasoline to not commit an arson. It makes no facts in the case more or less likely, and it's irrelevant. But it is incredibly prejudicial, as evidenced by the fact that it's one of the key pieces of evidence they're kind of hanging their hat on, but they're doing it in a very circular, conclusory way. In their arguments here in the motion, they're saying, well, obviously, it goes to, it makes it more likely that he committed an arson because he had it. Well, Mr. McCoy having gasoline isn't evidence that Mr. McCoy used gasoline in an arson. That's backwards. This is sort of a confirmation bias 101 classic example. It doesn't make any fact in the case more or less likely. It's irrelevant, and it doesn't pass this identification, this very, very low-lying bar, frankly, for identification as proposed in the cases that I cited. And so we do think that it should be inadmissible at trial. All
right. Commonwealth response?
Judge, the first thing I'd say is when you're deciding cases from 1911, there's going to be issues. I mean, it's clearly relevant under every applicable case law that's out there in the Commonwealth. You can't just look at Mr. McCoy's purchase of gasoline in a complete void, disregarding everything else that's happened on that day. Of course, it's relevant to the fact of whether a fire was set. By the time we get to the arson, there's going to have been introduced evidence that shows that Mr. McCoy burglarized the house, murdered the occupant of the house. So, of course, buying gasoline and gloves and then the house catching on fire are very relevant to this case. And I don't think the case law they cited applies to this instance at all, quite frankly. It just seems like they pulled out this instance in a void. Sure, if all we had was that Mr. McCoy went and got gasoline on the evening of the 16th of September, then yeah, it wouldn't be relevant, but that's not all we have, and that's why in my response I included the other evidence. It also doesn't consider the fact that circumstantial evidence is still evidence, and while it is circumstantial that he buys gas, shuts off his phone, in the house where he murdered somebody catches on fire, I think a jury could piece that together and say that, yeah, because of this, he caught that on fire. And I think that the fact that there was no accelerant used, or there was no accelerant found in the arson investigation, is going to be explained at trial by our arson investigator, who's going to say that in a large amount of times that the accelerant is consumed by the fire. It wasn't sent off to the lab for a couple days after the fire, because the court was aware initially this was not known to be a murder. And there's all kinds of factors that can make an accelerant not show up on a test, that it's not uncommon for a house that was burned down using gasoline to not come back with an accelerant. I think a reasonable jury can clearly find that Mr. McCoy committed this arson. I think that, as I say in my response, that him buying the gas can and filling it up with gas is just a link in the chain of evidence that's going to come in the trial. While it is circumstantial in nature, circumstantial evidence is still evidence, and as the court's aware, we don't need direct evidence to prove an offense. The court has said on numerous occasions that overwhelming circumstantial evidence can lead to a finding beyond a reasonable doubt that somebody committed an offense. I think the court should deny their motion to exclude that.
I am going to deny the motion. The court has had other arson cases where there's been testimony that the absence of an accelerant, proof of an accelerant, doesn't mean that there wasn't one used. So I'm going to deny that motion today. I think it could be relevant. Of course, there might be subject to other objections at trial, but I'm going to deny that motion today. All right, motion to strike, and I'll let Commonwealth tender an order to that effect. Motion to strike a burglary aggravator is unconstitutionally overbroad. Ms. Hyatt?
Yes, Judge.
Is this argument any different than the one we had in Livingston County?
No, Judge.
Okay, it's
so
the same one.
I was going to say our argument is that this aggravator doesn't properly narrow the class of eligible murder offenses
right.
to the worst of the worst. Our arguments are contained in the written motion. I know that the court has addressed this issue before, so I'm just going to defer to the...
That's why I wanted to see if there was anything different, because I spent a good deal of time reading those cases that you cited. And, okay.
No, Judge.
Nothing different. And Commonwealth has filed a response.
I did, Your Honor.
Well, I'm going to deny that one based on the same rationale I did in Livingston County. And I will do an order on that, okay? Motion to preclude admission of non-statutory aggravating circumstances and to require prosecutor to provide written victim impact state testimony in advance of trial. That was similar to one we addressed in Livingston County as well.
Yes, Judge. I think this issue also somewhat involves the motion noticing the assertion of rights under Marcy's law and part of the supplemental notice as well. So I'm kind of going to talk about these three different things at the same time, if that's okay. And when it comes to the motion pertaining to victim impact testimony, this I just want to acknowledge that family members from the Barnett family are here in court, so I don't want my arguments to come across as me trying to compound their grief or anything like that, because I realize this is really difficult to talk about in this setting. But I think that the issue is that because we're here on a death penalty case, there are certain heightened reliability restrictions that apply. And so when victim impact testimony falls underneath the umbrella of the Eighth Amendment, it's somewhat restricted in ways it might not be if the death penalty were not on the table. Because if we weren't talking about the death penalty, it would just be the truth in sentencing statute. That kind of testimony wouldn't be as heavily restricted as it is when we're talking about testimony within the context of a capital penalty proceeding. And like I said, unfortunately, it's the Eighth Amendment that restricts it in ways that it might not otherwise be restricted if the defendant weren't facing the death penalty. So that's why we want to make sure ahead of time that the testimony generally falls within those guidelines so that it doesn't become an issue during the penalty phase where
you know, if there's technically inadmissible aggravating evidence, that could result in a reversal. And so this is us asking for it in writing. Just a general summarization is to make sure that we're not going to run into any of those issues during the penalty phase at trial. So that's our request. I think in the context of the other case, I think we ultimately decided there might be some general outline of what that testimony might look like, and that's just what we're asking for in this case.
Your Honor, I did give notice that we're going to offer victim impact testimony. There's nothing in the law that I know of that requires it to be in writing. I have talked to the victims. If the victims wish to put something in writing, then I would obviously turn that over prior to the trial. But I don't know that there's anything that requires them to put it in writing.
And I cited law in Livingston County that said that the victim impact statement does not have to be in writing.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, I will specifically, Ms. Hyens, how would the Eighth Amendment in the context of a death penalty, I think I know what you're arguing, but specifically, how is it heightened with regard to victim impact as opposed to any other case?
So under St. Clair, technically, and this is why we're also going to talk about the supplemental notice, under the St. Clair case in Kentucky, technically, the only authorized non-statutory aggravator is victim impact testimony. And St. Clair held that it's constitutional error if the jury hears evidence in aggravation that is not properly admissible. So since the rules of evidence will apply to the penalty phase, there may be issues under 403 and issues in terms of caprice and there are issues in terms of it potentially becoming overly prejudicial because the jury can't base their decision to sentence someone to death based on the non-statutory aggravator. It has to be clear that eligibility is coming from whatever the predicate offense is and not the victim impact testimony. So that's just what we need to make clear. I think for the penalty phase, even though it can come in, it can't be non-statutory aggravating evidence that's going outside the bounds of what the Eighth Amendment permits. So it can't be so overly prejudicial that the jury is potentially making a decision based on that testimony versus their finding on the statutory aggravator. And so that is why we're making that request. And because it's technically non-statutory aggravating evidence, that's why...
Do you have any cases that rule this was a non-statutory aggravator that was admitted at trial in error?
I think St. Clair just establishes that it's a non-statutory aggravating evidence.
But do you have any cases that say in this trial there was a non-statutory aggravating evidence that was admitted in error to the prejudice of the defendant?
Judge, I just have, in the realm of Kentucky, this is sort of outside what the specific question you're asking, but that kind of evidence can be subject to exclusion when it is needed to avoid injustice. So then we're kind of centering.
So I guess what you are wanting to, I mean, the victims can testify and they can talk about Ms. Barnett and they can give a good context of her life and explain a bit about who she was and things like that at penalty.
Absolutely. So, I mean, if we have an understanding that that is all it will look like, then we're...
What would be too much, in your opinion?
I guess anything that potentially suggests that there's a particular outcome that they're looking for when it comes to a death or life decision would be improper.
All right. Okay.
Yeah, and I will say to her argument that the jury, I guess the concern is that the jury would make the decision on the aggravator based upon the victim impact as opposed to the statutory aggravator. But the jury's got to find beyond a reasonable doubt that the statutory aggravator exists. So I don't understand that argument. The jury won't get an instruction on the victim impact statement as far as an aggravator.
Okay. true. All right. Well, I think you've made your point, and I mean, I don't believe that trial that Commonwealth's going to be asking Ms. Barnett's family what their opinion is on the penalty. They will.
Frankly, I don't think we can.
Right, right.
So
I mean,
I will not be doing that.
Right. So I think if that's the limit you're looking at, I think that we're in agreement with that. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
And then I guess this is sort of, this issue is somewhat related. Now, the Commonwealth's notice of assertion of victims' rights pursuant to Marcy's law, the Commonwealth anticipates potentially calling two family members during the guilt portion of trial. And so my request, you know, we limit victim impact testimony pretty tightly in an Eighth Amendment context because we know how prejudicial it can be. And so normally, you know, it doesn't seem like they would plan on giving any kind of victim impact testimony during the merits phase. It would be about, you know, evidentiary issues. But still, if Marcy's law doesn't establish a right for the family to testify during the merits phase, and my thought process is, we need to, if there are ways in which we could avoid them having to testify during the merits phase, if that evidence can come in some other way, that would be our request. Because I imagine it could be emotional to talk about those kinds of things, even in the context of evidentiary issues. And that, again, may raise some 403 issues during the merits phase. So I think what we'd like is something in writing to show how you anticipate them testifying in the merits phase, because we may be able to stipulate on some of these things to not have them have to testify if it's unnecessary.
My understanding of the reason of the Commonwealth making that notice is such to put you all on notice that they would not be subject to what we call the rule of exclusion, right?
Yeah.
That they have a right under Marcy's law to be here even in spite of the rule of exclusion. That's the main reason, correct?
Yes, that's the reason I thought.
And so you all understand, and I think there is case law that supports that.
No issue with that. It's really the Commonwealth intends on calling Connie Rogers and Carol Noel as witnesses in the guilt portion of the trial. And so that's where I'm wondering if we could just get a notice of what.
And their testimony is supposed to be factual about that day or something?
That day and things they located a month or so later.
Not penalty phase type testimony.
No,
not victim impact at trial.
I understand we can't offer victim impact in the guilt phase of the trial, and we would not be doing that.
It seems like that could potentially come in through some other law enforcement officer, and so that's why our preference would be, even though that's the line of questioning, it's still going to be emotional for them to discuss these things.
I think
we need to worry about that as a defense.
But if there's a way to avoid that happening to begin with, if there are other ways in which that evidence can come in, that's what we would prefer.
So I think what you're saying is maybe we can stipulate to the evidence that they are going to offer. And we can obviously talk about that to see if we can enter into a stipulation. I don't think that the court should require me to do a filing as to what they're going to testify to, but I will give the court my word that we can talk about what the testimony is going to be, and if we can enter into a stipulation, then we will submit that to the court.
Yeah. All right.
I'm satisfied with that, Judge.
Anything else, Ms. Hines?
So now for us to specifically talk about the supplemental notice of aggravating circumstances, just generally, we would request a written, an opportunity to respond in writing. Now, there are three things that were noticed. The second part of it, which intent to offer victim impact testimony in the penalty phase of the trial, that's fine. That's authorized as non-statutory aggravating evidence. Now, the first one, I guess my understanding, also looking through the Commonwealth's tendered jury instructions, is that they're noticing another statutory aggravator that, instead of the burglary happening during the commission of the murder, they're saying a burglary happening during the commission of a kidnapping is also a statutory aggravator. Now, I just
you know, we haven't had a whole lot of time to look at this, but the statute says murder or kidnapping resulting in burglary, robbery, sodomy, whatever. And there's a Kentucky Supreme Court case, I'm pretty sure, that establishes it can't be the kidnapping plus one of these other things in order to be the predicate offense.
Well, I will let you all make a filing. You all just gotten this yesterday, and I will let you all, and if you didn't want to file a motion or something like that, there is a body of law that I'm familiar with as well that we probably ought to address, but I'll let you file. If you want to file a motion,
yeah, sure.
We'll let you do that. How about that in response to that?
That motion, I guess I'll respond to number three as well, because my issue is knowing that St. Clair is saying that the only non-statutory aggravating evidence permissible is victim impact testimony. I'm not sure, because we're in a complicated setting, because we're having a capital penalty phase with the truth in sentencing kind of combined in there as well. And the Commonwealth note said that they intend to offer testimony and exhibits pertaining to the defendant's criminal history, including the convictions received while the defendant was a juvenile and was certified as a youthful offender. So I guess my question is, I'm not sure I think I have an idea of the testimony and exhibits maybe, but that's all precluded by the truth in sentencing statute. And it's precluded by, say, like, they can get in the convictions, but they can't talk about the details.
Convictions can get in, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I agree. I'm just talking about judgments.
Oh, okay.
Final judgment.
The felony, while a juvenile, is admissible under the statute.
Okay. Yeah. Because I know that, you know, for instance, Brittany McCoy was interviewed, so I didn't know if the
I understand I can't get into that.
Okay.
I mean, we'll introduce testimony from a probation and parole officer about his criminal history, and we'll enter the final judgment.
Usually they introduce certified records of the final judgments in through the course of the testimony of the probation officer.
That sounds good, Judge, because I know when we were arguing that 404B issue on the kidnapping, we were talking about specific details of the offense, so I just wanted to clarify that.
I think the law is it's just convictions.
Yeah, and the court has declined to let me present that in the guilt phase. So
then I think that only issue is really number one, which we'll respond to in writing then.
All right, okay. Defense had a motion for disclosure of identity of expert witnesses. Commonwealth did file a response. Are you all satisfied?
Judge, I am. I don't need anything further. Thank you.
Any other motions today other than venue? We'll take up SMI and Sever on the 10th of January. Venue, the only thing left. Mr. Bonasak.
Your Honor, we had discussed last time we were here a motion specific to discovery related to Caldwell County case. My understanding was that the court asked for a memo on that, and then the court would take up in chambers anything coming from that. I may have gotten my dates confused. I wasn't sure when we would expect the memo. I just wanted to address that.
I don't think the court ordered me to file a memo. I filed a response stating that I have met with the KSP detective, and I don't find that anything is exculpatory in the case.
We had specifically asked about what our mechanism would be if we disagreed with the Commonwealth's findings, and we were under the impression that we would be providing something so that we could appeal that to the court if we disagreed. Is there a way we can get a copy of that?
I filed that into the records, yeah.
I did an order on that motion, and Commonwealth did make their filing in response.
Okay, for some reason, I wasn't noticed. We didn't get an email or anything either from Fortnite or from Commonwealth. Mm-hmm. So, okay. I'll look for that.
Anything else from anyone other than venue? Okay, if not, then we'll let defense. Do you all wish to just argue venue, or do you all have testimony you all have filed for?
Yeah, testimony,
okay. Do you all want to make any type of opening statement on your petition?
I don't, Judge.
You just want to take testimony, okay. both sides are ready to proceed, I'll let defense call their first witness.
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Go ahead, Ms. Boyarski.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll call April Rush.
April Rush?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Is she outside or?
She's right here.
Okay, Ms. Rush, please. Okay. Good morning, Ms. Afternoon, Ms. Rush. Do you swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give is the truth?
Yes. Thank you. Will you please state your name for the judge?
April Rush.
And is that APRILRUSH?
Yes. Okay.
And how are you employed?
I am a fact investigator for the Capitol Trials West Office for the Public Defenders.
And how long have you been an investigator?
I've worked for the Public Defender since 2018 in September, and I was previously a crime scene technician for the Louisville Metro Police Department.
I'm sorry, previously a what?
Crime scene technician. Okay. Sorry for the
Thanks. Louisville Metro
I'll Police scoot Department. Over so you can see.
This whole room is not laid out. Yeah, if you can speak up, Ms. Rush,
okay, yeah,
it's hard to hear in here. Are you the primary fact investigator for Jonathan McCoy in pending Trigg case 21CR13?
Yes, I am.
And in that capacity, have you been investigating the news and media, social media coverage related to Mr. McCoy's charges?
Yes, I have been.
Did you create a file with all of the news and media coverage that was known to you regarding this case?
Yes, I have.
And did you bring that file with you today?
I did.
I want to talk to you a little bit about your research there and what you uncovered. Can you tell the court, just based on your investigation, how many articles that you found related to this case?
Approximately 29, but it's possible that there's more, I'm sure.
Okay, so at least from what you in your investigation could find, you found 29 articles that have been printed or published related to this case since the charges, correct?
Yes.
Okay. I want to talk to you. Did you bring those articles with you today?
I did.
Okay. I want to talk to you a little bit about these articles. And I know there's 29 of them, and I brought a copy to provide to the court, and we won't go through all of them, Judge. But I do want to highlight some of what is contained, just so that the court has a general idea of what is being printed. One of the articles that you brought, and I've brought copies for the Commonwealth, if you'd like, and as well as the court. May I approach, Your Honor? I'd like to enter these into evidence.
Okay. Any objection? These will be admitted as defense cumulative for today. Number one, Mr. Warsher.
Did you have a chance to read all of these articles that we provided to the court today?
Yes, over time as I found them, I have looked them over.
And some of the information, let's talk about an article from WPKY. For example, mm-hmm. That was written on December the 8th of 2020.
Okay.
Can you tell the court what kind of, just generally, what kind of information is contained in that article?
That article is about a not guilty plea being entered. It contains a picture of our client. It names him as well as the victim. And it discusses the murder charge, how her house was set on fire, and that he is accused with tying the victim's hands behind her back, strangling her to death, and then setting fire to her home with her body still inside.
And that article identifies Mr. McCoy as a suspect, also identifies the victim, mm-hmm. and how facts relating to the allegations, correct?
Yes.
Okay. There's an article in here, it appears from the Times Leader, from December 5th of 2020. Can you tell the court just a little bit about what that article includes?
This is regarding the arrest of a suspect. It names our client, provides a photo. It identifies the victim and says that he was arrested for the brutal murder of the victim.
So this article characterizes the offense as brutal?
Yes.
in an article produced by the Kentucky State Police on December 3rd, what's contained in there?
It's also about the arrest of a suspect. It names the client as well as the victim, states that he was arrested for the brutal murder of the victim, and lists the charges as being kidnapping. It lists that is a Class A felony. It says murder, Class A felony. Arson, second, Class B. Tampering with physical evidence, Class D. And abuse of force, Class D.
So that article goes so far as to characterize the crime as brutal, but also lay out the level of offenses that have been charged as well.
That's correct.
In an article from the Lake News from December the 3rd, can you give a summary of that article?
Yeah, it's about the arrest of our client. It names our client, provides his picture, also states that they're looking for a female, provides a photo of Keisha, names our client, names the victim, and lists the charges as well with the classes. And explains that it was a brutal murder also.
So again, characterizes it.
Yes.
There's an article from the Associated Press from December the 3rd. What can you say about that article?
The title of this article reads as, Kentucky man charged with killing setting woman 81 ablaze. It names our client and lists the charges as murder, kidnapping, arson, evidence tampering, and abuse of court. And it also identifies the victim.
And uses the language that an 81-year-old woman was set ablaze.
That's how the title reads, yes.
And WBKO is the last one I'll ask you about. Anything there that stood out to you?
This is an initial article talking about KSP and the family pleading for answers in the murder of an 81-year-old woman, also described as brutal.
Okay. Now, these are just examples of some of the articles that we presented to the court. But in these articles, there are a lot of different sources of news. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
And are all of these news sources you were able to find, right?
Yes.
And so all of these would be available to the citizens of Trigg County, correct?
I would assume so, yes.
So regardless of any kind of media coverage area, anyone from Trigg County would have access to these kind of stories.
Yes.
And continually possibly see these stories, correct?
Yes.
To your knowledge, Ms. Rush, has a member of the news media been here at nearly every single court appearance that Mr. McCoy has had since 2020?
Going off just the consistency and frequency of articles that have been out there, I would assume that the media has probably been at most, if not all, yeah.
And so is it fair to say that there has steadily been reporting on the details of every court appearance to the citizens of Trigg County, either via radio, television, Twitter, Facebook, for over 4 years?
Yes.
I want to talk to you a little bit about social media. In the course of your investigation into the pretrial publicity that this case has received, did you investigate any comments made online by members of the public?
I did.
And did you create a file with that information?
I did.
Did you bring that file with you today?
Yes, I did.
Approach, Your Honor. We'll be asking the witnesses about this, and would like to introduce that as evidence as well.
Any objection, Sylvia Wiggins?
No, Your
Honor. We'll make these the second exhibit for defendant today.
Thank you, Your Honor. So in the course of investigating this pretrial publicity of this case, you said you investigated social media, is that correct?
Yes.
And did you create a document kind of summarizing your findings?
Yes.
Okay. And do you have that with you today?
I do.
I've provided a copy of that to the Commonwealth and the court. And I want to ask you some questions about that, okay? It appears that in this chart that you've created, you list the source of the news article or the source of the information, and then you list the name of people who have made comments. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And in these comments, isn't it true that people of Trigg County express their knowledge of the case, either that or the belief about Mr. McCoy's guilt, or opinions about his deserved punishment?
Yes.
How do you know, how were you able to ascertain that the people making these comments were Trigg County residents? Can you explain that?
Most of them just have their location, where they live or where they're from, on their Facebook page. So I went off of that.
And some these comments, like I said, appear to prejudge the case. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Or make opinions about the case.
Yes.
Let's go through some of these examples. On the first page, we have a Susan Smith. It says, location, Katy's, Kentucky.
Yes.
What's her statement that was made to the public regarding this case?
She said, "What a worthless sack of skin. I hope he rots in prison."
And that comment would have been available to anybody in the public who looked at it.
Yes.
On the next page, you have another quote or another comment from a Stan Powell from Katy's, Kentucky. And how did you determine that this person lived in Trigg County?
I believe I looked him up in Clear, because I don't think he had a address listed on his Facebook. And Clear is just a search that we can use to gather info on witnesses.
And with this article, there appears to be a picture of Mr. McCoy.
Yes.
And the comment made here by Mr. Powell was what?
The only time he should ever leave a cell is to be strapped to a gurney with a needle in his arm.
The next article is from WKDZ, which shows a picture of the defendant and myself sitting beside him. Is that correct?
Yes.
And can you go through these folks whose comments you have listed here, how you ascertained their location and the comments they made?
Yes. Melissa Hargis, it's listed on her Facebook that she's in Katy's. Her comment is, "He needs to pay for all the crimes. Miss Eileen was a precious little lady that wouldn't hurt anyone." Diane Darnell was the next to leave a comment. Their location is unknown. It did not list it on their Facebook.
But still public to everyone?
Yes. Their comment was, "Damn his rights. He deserves none." Karen Simmons listed on her Facebook that they lived in Katy's, and her comment was, "This gives defense attorneys a bad name." And Tracy Kenahan is in the Trigg-Hopkinsville area based on her Facebook, and their comment was, "Wow."
If you continue to the next page, there's another article from WKDZ that was printed. Can you go through those comments and locations of those people?
Yes. The first was from a Chuck Poole. I am not aware of his location. It did not list it on his Facebook. His comment was, "Guest taxpayers will pay $40,000 a year for his free housing, medical, etc." Tammy Mason had her location as Katy's. Her comment was, "Low life POS. She was such a sweet lady, one of the sweetest ever. No excuse for this crime." Christy Robinson, I put "likely" in Katy's. That was most likely because it probably didn't state specifically on her profile, but posts maybe perhaps indicated that that is the area that she lived in. And their comment is just several thumbs up emojis. Tanya Bruce, Katy's, based on her profile, her comment is just "awesome." And Carrie Lynn Gray, Katy's, based on her Facebook, "praying for justice for Eileen."
Okay. And then these comments, I think, continue on to the next page, if you will.
Yes. James Gray, Eddyville, based on his profile, "useless killing." Trudy Shepherd, Katy's, based on their profile, comment, "awesome news." Jeannie Rogers, Trigg County area, based on their Facebook, "great news."
On the next page, Evelyn Keenan made a comment in response to a WKDZ article, and several others made comments. Can you highlight those for the court?
Yes. One of the initial comments was Tammy Mason, who has commented before, so her name is just in a previous part of this chart.
Okay.
Tammy states, trial please. This was one of the sweetest ladies in Trigg County, and she deserves justice. 2 years we have been paying to keep these folks up. Evelyn Keenan replied, I have her location as unknown because I am not sure where she's from, replied with, yeah, that's just like that Dunlap guy that killed those three children in Cerulean, burned their house, and attempted to kill their mother. There was a trial. He has been arrested, but he's still sitting in prison, and the taxpayers are paying for his upkeep. Why not just give him the same fate that he gave her children, death? And then Tammy Mason replied, yes, ma'am. Further comments are from a Teresa Ernie. Their location is also unknown. The comment is, no bond. Trial needs to happen. This has gone on too long. Think of the heartache and trauma he has caused this family. Rhonda Bentley, location Katie's, based on their Facebook, comment, no bond reduction, no bond at all. And Ron Scholler, Katie's, based on his Facebook, comment, shouldn't even be a bond, let's get to the trial. And comments from that post continue on to the next page if you want me to keep
going. Yeah, go ahead and finish that.
Okay. Zachary Lieber, Katie's, based on his Facebook, comment, can we just have a trial already, please? Geez, there's absolutely no excuse for it to take this long. Bond shouldn't be an issue. Have a trial already. A Trudy Sova replied to his comment, I have their location as unlikely. Trigg County area possible. Again, that was
as likely Trigg County.
Likely, just okay. Based on their Facebook. And her reply was, maybe they want to see if he can rob Jersey Mike's too. Guys on ankle bracelets seem to like to do that while out on bond. Another comment under that by Stan Powell, who has already been mentioned earlier. This POS should never see the outside of a jail again. And a comment by R. Sue Martin King. Again, Katie's, based on their profile, that just states trial.
And this is by no means exhaustive of the comments that have been made by the public on, made public on the internet, basically.
No, I'm sure there's potentially more, yes.
Just a couple more questions. Did you, when you were doing your research, did you happen to look at the population of registered voters in this county?
Yes, I did.
And did you, what source did you use to look at this?
It's the Kentucky voter registration website.
Okay, so it's a public state website that lists this information.
Mm-hmm.
And it provides statistics, correct, of how many registered voters are available by county in Kentucky, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And can you tell the court how many registered voters are available potentially, if going off of jury records,
mm-hmm.
or going off of these voter registration records for jury summons?
Intrigue?
Yes.
12,017.
12,017.
Yes.
How many are there in Christian County?
Christian has 50,896.
50,000. And what about in Callaway County?
Callaway is 29,914.
That's all the questions I have for you, Ms. Rush. The Commonwealth may have some.
Ms. Rush, starting with the Facebook comments,
mm-hmm.
As you were testifying, I was trying to go through and see particularly what the dates were on each of these posts. What is the most recent post that you have provided to the court?
Most likely April 15th of this year. That would be on the third page, I think. It doesn't have a year.
It doesn't have a year. So
yeah.
Are you sure about that?
No, I mean, I can't say 100% for sure, but I put this together this year, so I'm assuming that it doesn't have a year because it was taking place in 2024, but I would have to go back and check, yeah.
Okay, so I've counted 24 comments. Does that sound right to you? And that is over this span of over 4 years. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe so.
4 years, that's a pretty long period of time, correct?
Yeah.
And you think 24 comments is excessive?
Not necessarily. This is just what I have found so far and put into this chart. There's absolutely more, I'm assuming, out there that I haven't come across.
Well, so this is your job, right, to investigate this? So
not just this specifically, but yes.
Well, if there were more comments that were helpful to you, mm-hmm. would you not have produced those to the court today?
Yeah, if I came across them, I would have.
Okay, so as we sit here today, mm-hmm. you have provided to the court 24 comments over a period of 4 years.
Yep.
Is that right?
That's correct.
All right, 29 articles mm-hmm. also over the period of 4 years. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And so you talk specifically about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, mm-hmm. all in December of 2020.
Yes, that's okay. What I was asked about.
Yeah. So the specific ones that you talked about were over 4 years ago, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do you recall looking at the last WKDZ post about the defendant?
Do you have the date?
I don't.
Is it December 11th? Is that what
it would have been the last court date.
Yes, I do have a copy of that in there, yeah.
Okay. And I don't see any comments that you have produced to the court on that post. Do you know how many likes or shares or comments there were on that latest post?
No.
You don't know?
Not off the top of my head.
Okay. So you didn't check that, the most recent?
Not on Facebook, just this news article.
Okay. Did you check and see what percentage of people in Trigg County get a subscription to the Times Leader?
No.
Okay. And how about the late news?
No.
Okay. And you don't have any evidence that anyone in the jury pool even saw any of these Facebook posts, comments, or articles, do you?
No, not necessarily.
No further questions.
Ms. Boyarski.
Ms. Rush, you wouldn't have to necessarily have a subscription to these news outlets to get this information, correct?
No, I don't.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Wolfe-Wiggins.
No further questions.
Court has just a question of you, Ms. Rush. Are you aware that in addition to registered voters, driver's license lists are used to make jurors mm-hmm. and also income tax returns? I think that's still the law. It was at one time.
Yeah.
So, okay. You aware of that?
Yes.
Okay. And that would increase the jury pool.
Yes, most likely.
Not much, but
yes.
Some.
Yes.
Yeah. Any other questions?
No questions, and I have another witness.
Okay. Any other questions, Ms. Obi-Wan?
No, Your Honor.
You may step down, Ms. Rush.
Thank you.
Your other witness.
Thank you, Judge. I'd like to call Aaron Kincaid.
Aaron Kincaid. Ms. Kincaid. Where from the testimony you're about to give is the truth.
Yes, sir.
And could you please spell your first and last name?
Aaron, E-R-I-N, Kincaid, K-I-N-C-A-I-D.
Thank you, Ms. Kincaid.
Thank you. And you've already stated your name, so I'll ask you how you're employed.
I'm currently a private investigator and mitigation specialist with AK Investigations based in Nashville. But I work out of the Louisville area.
Okay, so you have multiple locations for your office then?
Yes.
Okay. And how long have you been an investigator?
I started as an investigator with the Capital Trials Branch in DPA in October of 2013. Prior to that, I'd been working as a law clerk with two different capital teams in Colorado following my graduation and taking the bar in Colorado. From law school, and I was with DPA until the end of January of 2022, and then began with AK February 1st of 2022, so almost 3 years.
Okay. And are you, in this case, this pending Trigg County case of Mr. McCoy's 21 CR 13, are you the primary mitigation specialist?
Yes.
In that capacity, Ms. Kincaid, were you asked to speak to citizens of Trigg County regarding this case?
Yes, I was.
And were you able to do that?
Yes.
And could you just tell the court how you went about that, what your process was, and what happened?
Sure. So Ms. Rush, who just testified, and I came to Katie's on, I can't remember the exact date.
Okay.
It's on the affidavits that people signed. We it was actually a pretty cold and blustery day too, and so first we decided we'd start with the main street businesses here in Katy's mm-hmm. and talk to people inside the businesses about their knowledge of the case. The first business we went into, I can't remember if it's a travel agency or a realtor that's just right up the way here, and there were two sort of maybe in their 50s or 60s year old gentlemen that we spoke to. We explained, you know, we work for one of the defendant's attorneys. We're here talking to citizens about their knowledge of this particular case that is coming up for trial, and what kind of, you know, discussion among the community there's been about the case, what kind of media coverage they were aware of. And they immediately knew the case and told us that they had basically come up with with Ms. Barnett and her daughters.
And by come up, you mean kind of grown up together in the community?
And had known them basically their whole lives.
And these are the first people you spoke to?
The very first people that we spoke to. And the one of the gentlemen said, well, he needs to hang for what he did to Ms. Barnett. And that they're all guilty and they all need to be basically punished for what happened here.
And when you say, did he indicate who he was referring to when he said they're all guilty?
Well, we had said, are you familiar with the defendants?
Okay.
And listed Jonathan McCoy, Keisha Stewart, and Allison Hunter. And he said, oh yeah, they're all guilty, and they all, you know, should be punished for what they're accused of for doing that. And so we... Obviously, they were not going to be interested in signing an affidavit.
Right.
And we thanked them for speaking with us and moved on to, it was like a gift and floral shop just a little bit further down. Similarly, that person, I don't know if she was the owner or working there, but she also was sort of probably in her 60s or so woman, and she also knows the Barnett family and knew Ms. Thelma. And she said, oh, well, they're all guilty and they all need to be, you know, go away for what they did. And then told me that she couldn't believe that Miss Barnett was killed over her vehicle and that it was all for a stolen vehicle. Which was a little confusing to me and Ms. Rush because that's not a fact alleged in this case.
Mm-hmm.
But she said it with certainty. That was why Ms. Barnett had been killed.
Did she indicate what the source of this misinformation was?
No.
Okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
So she also, throughout the discussion, everybody was very polite, but she was very reluctant, and I think a little bit misunderstood what we were asking about with the venue. She kept saying, I'm not going to court, I'm not testifying to anything, and we reassured her a few times that's not what we're asking you to do. We're just asking, you know, what you know about what's going on in the community information-wise, and she was just not getting involved, and so, again, thanked her for her time, and moved on.
Okay.
And we decided, all right, we're going to need kind of a more public place to speak to more people.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we went down to the Food Giant down the road and stood right outside the doors and just stopped customers as they were entering and exiting the Food Giant, and employees too. There were employees in and out as well. Some people kind of did the thing like anyone does when Greenpeace is trying to get you to like sign a petition, you know, like duck their head and avoid us. So obviously we didn't talk to people that did that.
Yeah.
But what we said to everybody as we stopped them was, hi, can I ask you a question? We're not selling anything. We'd just like to ask you a question. If they said yes, then we would say, are you a citizen in Trigg County or a nearby county? And based on that answer, then we'd ask, are you familiar with, you know, the news coverage here and what's going on? And then if that was also a yes, we continue to talk about, are you familiar with, you know, the charges against Jonathan McCoy and his defendants, Keisha Stewart and Allison Hunter? Do you remember seeing news coverage about that case? And then if the answer was yes to that, then we also would explain we're out here, you know, talking to people about the knowledge in the community and whether or not the community believes that Mr. McCoy and his co-defendants could receive a fair trial in Trigg County for what they're charged with. And then asked, is that something, do you think that that is possible? If not, are you comfortable signing an affidavit to that effect?
So some of those people that you found in the community felt strongly enough about their position that they wanted to sign an affidavit.
People,
to that effect.
Yeah, and other people said, well, I'm familiar with it, I remember hearing about it, but I don't really know. There were people who didn't want to be involved, and we also encountered several other people who declined to speak with us because of their acquaintance or friendship or closer with the Barnetts.
Did you have a copy of the defendant's petition for change of venue with you?
I did.
And had you read that prior to asking the citizens of Trigg County about it?
I have.
And so you had a copy with you that you were available to show them?
Yes.
And see if they supported what was in that document before signing the affidavit, correct?
Yes. So if they said yes to us that they were interested in signing an affidavit, mm-hmm. in support of a venue change, then I gave them the copy of the petition, mm-hmm. to look over and told them, take as much time as you want to review this, and when you're done, if you still want to sign the affidavit, then we can do that. And
okay.
So everyone who had agreed to sign the affidavit still agreed after reading through the petition to the extent that they felt like reading it.
Understood.
I didn't force anyone to read every word of a motion.
Yes,
most
but they had it in front of them.
It wasn't me holding on to it. I handed it to each of them so that they could read it at their leisure.
Okay. Did any of these folks that signed an affidavit or that you talked to otherwise that day, mm-hmm. indicate where they got their information? Like, was it from a media source? Was it rumor mill, word of mouth? Did they, any of them, say where that belief had come from?
I don't remember anybody citing anything particular. I do know we were asking, do you remember hearing about this in the news? Mm-hmm. And a number of people, I couldn't tell you how many of the people, but a handful of people were like, oh, yes. Obviously, there were people who had personal knowledge of it because they knew Ms. Barnett or other people in the case. But I can't remember specific citations to.
And I think you've probably already answered my next question, but you testified that some of these people that had knowledge of the case, mm-hmm. either had misinformation about the case,
yes.
or they had already formed an opinion as to Mr. McCoy's guilt or innocence or how he should be punished, it sounds like.
Yes.
And you didn't know any of these people, correct?
Not one.
You had never met any of them prior?
No.
So you had no idea what they were going to say to you?
Mm-hmm. I didn't even know if they lived here or not when I approached them.
Has Mr. McCoy indicated that he doesn't believe he can get a fair trial in Trigg County?
Yes. That has been...
And why?
Well, that's been an important issue to Mr. McCoy from the start of his case. He's several generations of McCoys who've lived and grown up in this area. That name has a bit of an infamous reputation, and he's aware of that. He's aware of how small this community is, how tight-knit this community is, and that... not just his name, but the names of his co-defendants are known to people in this area, and that he would not be able to get out from under basically people's belief about his reputation and who he is in this county. He's expressed that concern repeatedly over the last 4 years.
Okay. Thank you. That's all the questions I have for you.
So you said your office is actually primarily in Louisville?
I work out of Louisville. I'm the only one. The rest of them are based in Nashville.
Okay. And so all of the communications you had with people in Trigg County occurred on one day in November of 2024?
For those affidavits, yes.
And how long were you in Trigg County on that day talking to Trigg County residents?
Probably few hours.
All right, you said the first people you talked to, that's how you referenced them. I didn't hear a name. Do you have any idea who you were talking to?
They were the people behind the counters in the two businesses we went into.
So you have no names of the people that you talked to?
No.
Same thing with the florist. You have no idea who that was you were talking to? How did you identify yourself when you were approaching people?
Ms. Rush and I explained that we were investigators who were hired by the attorneys representing Mr. McCoy, and that we were there speaking with citizens about the media saturation and not community knowledge about the cases against Mr. McCoy and his co-defendants.
And so these affidavits that you've submitted, are these all affidavits that you obtained while standing out of the in front of the food giant?
Yes, ma'am.
Jesse Parrish, what do you know about Mr. Parrish other than you saw him at the food giant?
I don't know anything personally about any of the affiants.
So you have no idea where Mr. Parrish works or if he is involved in the community in any way?
No, and that wasn't required to find
out.
That's
not my question. Do you know anything about Mr. Parrish?
No, I don't.
Okay, thank you. And what did you do to verify that all these people were actually Tree County residents?
By asking them, and then they signed a sworn notarized statement as to that, knowing it would go to court.
Okay, same question for Patricia Fields. Do you know anything about Ms. Fields, where she works,
how long she's lived in Tree County? I don't know anything personally about any one of the affidavits.
Okay. And that includes no knowledge of how involved they are in the community, how much contact they have with any other Trigg resident, or what they may do for a living.
We discussed when we approached them, are you a citizen here? Have you been here, you know, during the pendency of this case that started in 2020? But beyond that, I wasn't checking IDs or, you know, tax returns or their voter registration to verify how long they've been here.
What did Mr. Parrish tell you specifically about what he had heard about the case?
I can't attribute specific comments to any of them. I don't remember who was who, to be honest.
And you didn't make any notes on that?
I did not.
Well, in Mr. Parrish's affidavit, it says he has read and heard news media coverage of the charges. But you didn't talk to him about what specific facts he recalled?
No, I specifically explained the case, the charges, and the victim's name, and asked if he was familiar with the case and had heard about that through news or social media or in the community.
All right, you testified that you talked to some people that knew the victim's family. Did you ask the individuals that you talked to if he knew the defendant, they knew the defendant?
We asked everybody if they were familiar with these people. That was part of the kind of precursor conversation with everybody.
And you testified that you talked to people familiar with the victim's family, but you didn't testify that you encountered anybody familiar with the defendant?
Not specifically, no.
Okay, so nobody that you talked to, either at the food giant or these businesses, voiced that they had any knowledge personally of the defendant?
No.
You said the defendant is concerned that he won't get a fair trial. How long has he lived in Tree County? How many years of his life did he live in Tree County?
A lot. I mean,
She
said that his family had been here for generations, so I think
so
she has opened the door.
He was born here in 1978 and remained in Trigg County until about 14 or 15 years old. But his family has remained here, his siblings, his grandmother lives a few blocks from here. And he's always maintained contacts with people in Trigg County throughout his life, whether he's lived in Trigg County or not.
But you haven't submitted an affidavit from anyone, or you don't have any proof from anyone that has said, I know Jonathan McCoy, or I know his family, and I can't give him a fair trial.
No.
No further questions.
Anything else, Ms. Warren?
No.
Court does it. Is Mr. McCoy's father from Trigg County?
Yes. Well, I think Marshall Trigg, both.
Okay.
Linton in Linton area is where the McCoy family's from.
Any other proof, Ms. Boyarsky?
No proof, Your Honor. No further proof.
Okay. Ms. Ovi Wiggins?
Your Honor, I have submitted 3 affidavits, and I also have a witness that's Chief of Police, Tyler Thomas.
Okay. Chief Thomas? You swear from the testimony about to give is the truth.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead and state your name for the record, please.
Tyler Thomas.
And where are you employed?
Case Police Department.
What is your current title?
Chief of Police. Now, excuse me, I've got signs.
I think we're all struggling with that right now. How long have you been the Chief of Police?
Almost 2 years.
And prior to being the Chief, were you employed as a police officer at the Cadiz Police Department?
Yes, I was the Assistant Chief prior to being appointed the Chief.
How long total have you been in law enforcement in Tree County?
Between 13 and 14 years.
In your capacity as Chief of Police in Cadiz, do you interact frequently with the public, with the citizens of Tree County?
Daily.
Based upon your interaction with the citizens of Tree County, do you have an opinion as to whether Jonathan McCoy can receive a fair trial in Tree County?
My opinion would be yes, due to the simple fact of everybody that I talk to is not specific on whether or not they want to see him specifically receive a guilty verdict or a not guilty verdict. However, we do know that the same year that this offense occurred was not the only offense of this nature that occurred in Tree County. There were multiple, I believe 4 or 5 murders happened that year in the county. And I think equally every single offense took the same notoriety in the public.
Okay, so what you've heard is more general discussion on maybe the amount of murders that occurred in Tree County as opposed to specifics about the defendant's case. Is that a fair statement?
Just the general concept of crime that particular year.
And you were in the room when there was testimony about Facebook posts and articles. Have you heard any specific conversation among the citizens of Tree County about the articles, any specific facts that may have been in the articles or any Facebook posts?
Not specific facts, no.
Thank you. No further questions.
Ms. Boyarsky.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Thomas,
how would you go about talking to these citizens that you referenced about the McCoy case? In what context would that come up?
Being as how I don't have any actual involvement with the case, I would not converse with them about something this nature, due to the simple fact if they develop an opinion about me as a public servant, then I wouldn't want them to think that I would be apt to talk negatively or positively about a suspect or a victim in any case, because that could cause somebody to have an adverse opinion about my office, me as the Chief of Police and a public servant of the community.
So no one has ever voluntarily come up to you and said, I think I want to talk to you about Mr. McCoy and his co-defendants, and I think they can all get a fair trial here. Has that happened?
No, nobody has came up to me and said that they exactly what you said, but
okay.
They haven't said the opposite either.
So it's fair to say that you don't honestly know how the people of Tree County feel about this, because in your own words you said they're not going to talk to you about a pending case, or you're not going to talk to them about a pending case.
I'm not going to talk to them. If somebody came to me to offer some information, I would receive that.
Right, but that hasn't happened.
No.
Okay. And how did you get involved in signing this affidavit?
The Commonwealth attorney approached me and asked me if I would testify on the behalf of this case, and being as hell that I have the ear of the public, you may say, to give my opinion in the matter.
And thank you. And did you know Ms. Ovi Wiggins prior to her asking you to testify?
Yes.
How long have you known her?
As long as she's been the assistant, now full-time Commonwealth attorney, as long as my law enforcement career has been in Tree County.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything else, Ms. Ovi Wiggins?
No further questions, Your Honor.
You may step down, Chief. Thank you. Any other proof for the Commonwealth?
No, Your Honor.
Anything else from either side?
Judge, I'd like to make an argument.
Go right ahead.
If I may.
Do you have an argument as well, Ms. Obie Wiggins?
I can make a statement if she's going to argue.
You can go first and we'll let her.
Thank you, Judge. I don't think there's any doubt that pretrial publicity has had an impact on this case. I think that it's fair to say that extensive coverage has inflamed the passions and prejudices of the citizens of Trigg County, and rightfully so. But whether it be from media coverage, word of mouth, or rumor mill, any other source, many citizens of this county have either heard about the case, formed a preconception about either the facts, which may likely be incorrect, the guilt of Mr. McCoy, or the punishment that they would impose. And I think it's evident that people in this county have formed an opinion on the issues without having heard one piece of evidence. This makes them biased, and the ability for Mr. McCoy to have a fair trial in this county impossible. I think it's evident from the comments that were made to our investigators and that have been posted by the public that these residents formed an opinion and then are also exposing other potential jurors to this bias by posting their opinions publicly. Every juror in Trigg County has access to all of these news sources, Judge. And because this community is so small, it's easy to understand how bias could be spread by word of mouth. I think there's a difference, an obvious difference, in the way that the defense and the Commonwealth went about ascertaining affidavits. And I think that that's important. I think in the Commonwealth's affidavits or in their response, I believe it says, you know, that there's citizens who think that he can get a fair trial here. Well, of course there are. That's the baseline. But the problem is there are people in this community who do have knowledge of it and who have spread that knowledge. And the people that we got affidavits from were random. And I think that reflects more accurately the sentiments of the community going out to public venues and finding people who were willing to talk rather than going to someone that we knew. I analogize, you know, Ms. Obie Wiggins asking the chief of police whether Mr. McCoy can get a fair trial to me going over to the local public defender's office and asking the attorneys there if he could get a fair trial. I think it's pretty obvious what those people would say. But I think the bottom line is that mere knowledge of the parties involved or having been exposed to the media coverage involving the case can even create an unconscious bias, if you will, that's not even recognized by the jurors themselves, you know. So we could have a panel of jurors come in here and say, yes, I've heard about the case, and I can give you, I can be fair and impartial. You know, what every juror will say, I can be fair and impartial. And they may say that without the understanding that deep inside of them, they have recollection of the McCoy family or the Barnett family, or they have reasons to prejudge this case that would prevent them from being fair and impartial, despite what they may say, is what I'm saying. Mr. McCoy, from the outset of this case, Judge, has been concerned that he would not be able to get a fair trial in Trigg County. And I think his concerns are valid. The McCoy family has been in Trigg County for generations, and their large family is known to many. And in addition, the other key defendants and witnesses in this case are also from Trigg County, and I think that's important. Keisha Stewart and Allison Hunter, my understanding is that they're both Trigg County residents. Ms. Barnett and her family are also extremely well known in this community, Judge. Any potential juror with familiarity of these parties creates a bias that violates his constitutional right to a fair and impartial jury. His life is literally at stake. And I think in a case of this magnitude that it's more imperative that an impartial trial is conducted than it normally would be because of the potential consequences. Now, in my motion, Judge, I propose that the case be tried in Christian or Callaway counties, which are both adjoining counties to Trigg County. And the reason why, I know the Commonwealth said in their response that no reason was given. The reason is we simply have a larger jury pool available to us there. And in addition, I think it's important to note that both Callaway and Christian counties have a large transient population due to Christian County having the military base there, Callaway County having the university there. It increases the likelihood that people are not going to remember news coverage or haven't heard about it in those communities. Both counties, in addition, have alternate circuit courtrooms in their jurisdiction, so we wouldn't have to worry about, you know, taking up somebody's courtroom while that court was wanting to conduct their regular business. We would have other courtrooms available to us in those jurisdictions. The Commonwealth proposed that if the court moves the trial, that it should be moved to Lyon or Livingston County. We object strongly to both of those counties or any other county in the 56th Circuit. And I think that the four counties in this judicial circuit are very intertwined, and I think they're all inappropriate because Livingston and Lyon, as Ms. Rush told us, have even less potential jurors than Trigg County does. And that doesn't make nearly half of the potential jurors that Trigg County has. That'd make it very difficult to seat a jury there. Also, I think it's important to note that what I believe is the most recent death sentence in Kentucky came out of Livingston County. In Lyon County,
09? I mean,
Dunlap. I think that's the second most recent death verdict.
So other than Dunlap, there's only been one other death verdict in Kentucky?
Yes. Since then.
Since
most recent is what I'm saying, yes.
I didn't realize that.
And then also in Lyon County, Judge, we've got a population, we've got a prison there. We've got a population of death row inmates that many of our potential jurors we would be drawing from there are probably connected to the prison, employees of the prison, and have a, you know, inherent bias there. So I think that those don't make any sense. I think we're just getting ourselves into creating a larger problem rather than fixing it by moving the trial there. The Commonwealth cited the Grooms case in their response, and the Grooms case was a Lyon County case, and the court denied a change of venue, but it proved extremely difficult to sit a jury there, is my understanding, and I don't want us to have to go through that. Mr. McCoy cannot receive a fair trial in Trigg County, and we ask the court to grant our petition and move the trial to Christian or Callaway County, and I would ask the court to make a ruling on the merits of our petition. Thank you.
Ms. Holloway.
Your Honor, the burden is on them to show that the defendant cannot receive a fair trial in Trigg County, and they just haven't done it. They presented 29 articles to the court over a span of 4 years, 24 Facebook comments over a span of 4 years, and 5 affidavits that they can't even tell the court anything about these people. You know, we did go about getting affidavits differently. I asked people about their thoughts on the issue of whether the defendant could get a fair trial that I knew interacted daily with the public and were in tune with what Trigg County citizens thought. And so we've submitted the affidavits of 3 people who are out in the public who believe that he can get a fair trial. If there were more things that they believed would prevent him from getting a fair trial here, they would have presented it. So, again, the court's looking at a motion to change venue on very limited articles, very limited comments, and 5 affidavits from we don't know who they are other than their name, and they live in Trigg County. I think the statement that many citizens of Trigg County has formed an opinion, I don't know where they come up with that. I just don't think that is a statement that is supported by what they have presented. even the investigator, if I understood her testimony right, said that the people that they talked to didn't have any knowledge of the defendant. They've told you that he's been very concerned because of his family and the knowledge that or they've lived here and afraid that all these people know him and would hold that against him. But they didn't talk to anybody that indicated they knew Jonathan McCoy or his family. You know, all the issues, if there are any, that they've talked about, the, you know, the pretrial publicity, knowledge of parties, those are things that will be meshed out in individual voir dire. And the court, obviously, will be very thorough on that, as will the attorneys. So with what the court has been given, I think it's clear that the court has to deny the motion.
I'll take the matter under advisement and make a ruling very soon, okay?
Thank you, Judge. Thank you.
Anything else today?
Not from the Commonwealth. Nothing from defense, okay. Judge.
So our next hearing in this case will be January 10th, correct? We're not having anything on rule day January 8th, correct?
Correct.
All right, we'll see you all January the 10th at 9 a.m. that morning.
Judge, may Ms. Wiggins and I approach?
You may.
Okay.